You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Contrary to what you may have heard, the middle class is not dying and robots are not stealing our jobs. In fact, according to one of our leading public voices on economic issues, the 21st century economic paradigm offers new ways of making money, fresh paths toward professional fulfillment, and unprecedented opportunities for curious, ambitious individuals to combine the things they love with their careers. Adam Davidson is the creator of NPR's Planet Money podcast and an award-winning New Yorker staff writer with a new book that explains our current economy, laying out its internal logic, and revealing the transformative hope it offers for millions of people to thrive as they never have before. The book is called The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century, and today Adam Davidson joins me on the podcast to talk about it. He describes his father and grandfather as examples of two different approaches to work and money and says we're now entering an economy that combines the best of both. He explains how to tell between a hobby and a passion, how globalization and the internet allow you to monetize that passion like never before, and why it's important to have what he calls the Goldilocks of business models, lest you get undercut or replaced by bigger companies, foreign competition, or automation. Plus, he shares some surprising examples of people who are making the passion economy work for them, including one man who only sells to the Amish, a brush company that took the most basic of products and turned it into a high-priced specialty item for NASA, and an accountant who found his passion by helping others pursue their own. Coming up with Adam Davidson in just a moment. Adam Davidson is the co-founder of NPR's Planet Money podcast, a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he covers economics and business, and the CEO of Uncanny 4, a leading podcast company. He has won many of journalism's most prestigious awards, including a Peabody for his coverage of the financial crisis, and now he's out with a new book titled The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century. Adam, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I really enjoyed this book. It's a fascinating read on how to sort of bolster ourselves against everything that's happening with automation and AI and free trade and so forth. And you tell some very interesting stories in this book. You start out actually with telling your own story and the story of what you call the two Stanleys, your dad and your grandfather, who apparently had very different approaches to work, money, priorities, life. Tell us a little about them.
Sure. It actually was late in the process. My wife was saying, you know, your family is the story you're telling. Because the story I'm telling is about a dramatic shift in how our economy works and you know, a massive transformation from one kind of economic logic to a new kind. And that has caused a lot of pain and fear, obviously. But it also has a lot of positive attributes, things that you can take advantage of to succeed in ways no one else ever succeeded. And to tell that story, I do start. So my grandfather, Stanley Davidson, was like if you just imagine the perfect American man for the 20th century, just this tall, strong. I really always truly thought he looked like Superman. He had big, thick head of black hair into his 90s. And he, in the Depression, found himself at 18 with a wife and a baby on the way and needed a job, got a job at a rough factory that made machine tools, and worked two shifts a day, worked constantly for 50-something years in the same factory, and never loved his job. Wouldn't have, I don't think, ever occurred to him to wonder if he would love his job. It was, he's a man provides, and a man provides by doing work. And when I asked my dad what he knew about his dad's work, he said, I never knew what he did, just really? That it was awful. That's all. Just he seemed unhappy.
He basically made widgets, right? Or ball
yeah,
bearings?
He made the machines that make ball bearings.
The machines that make ball bearings.
Yes. Okay. And he's very, because he was an age where he could have gone to World War II and didn't, he would, you know, always had the saying, you can't fight a world war without ball bearings. He wanted to be clear. He was part of the effort. And when I think of Stanley, my grandfather, it's a world that we know. It's a world where work and making money to support your family is a priority, especially for a man in that era. And the idea that he would even wonder, like, what would my dreams be? What would my – he would never – it never occurred to him to – what would be uniquely mine?
Yeah.
And then – this little baby is born in 1936 and eventually becomes my dad. And in blue-collar, working-class Worcester, Massachusetts, my dad was just a terrible fit. My dad was a passionate weirdo who wanted to perform and wanted to tell jokes and never wanted to have some crappy job he didn't love. And eventually my dad decided he wanted to be an actor. And to his father... what are you talking about? That is insane. Like, we've never met an actor. No one in the family had ever seen a play. Like, no one, why not say, I want to be a butterfly? I want to be a fairy who flies to the moon. And my dad knew when he decided to be an actor in the early 60s that choice meant he would not be financially secure, that following his passions meant veering away from his father and not providing for his family. And I grew up in subsidized housing for artists in Greenwich Village in New York. And we weren't desperate, but money was a constant worry in the house I grew up in. And like many just kind of working actors, and my dad was successful.
The starving artist, or the not quite starving artist.
but not thrive, like not secure.
Right.
And he and my dad would tell us as a kid, like, you can either make money or you can follow your passion. And I think that was true then. But the point of my book now is that because of this transformation in the economy, now you actually can do both. You can be both of the Stanleys. My dad goes by Jack Davidson, but his real name is Stanley Jack Davidson, like his dad. And you can follow your passion and make money and provide for your family. And I would argue increasingly you actually have to, that this economy does not reward people like my grandfather who are just willing to work hard at a job they don't like and just do it. That's not as good a recipe for success as finding out what makes you uniquely you, how do you fit into this economy. And it doesn't mean you get to do whatever you want. I mean, you have to combine both the passion of my dad and the practicality of my grandfather.
Yeah. Now, why are we transitioning to a passion economy? Is it automation and AI? Is it China? What are the forces at play here?
You literally just name them. Yeah, it's computerization, automation, it's global trade, particularly China, outsourcing. The way I would frame it is the way I think most people think the world works, like our frame of, that's how an economy works, is actually just a tiny blip in human history.
Interesting.
The Industrial Revolution-fueled corporate century of the 20th century is created a whole bunch of conditions that are utterly unlike anything that had ever come before. You know, before 1900, the vast majority of people who've ever lived are farmers, subsistence farmers, you know, there's obviously
small artisans,
cobblers, working in a local environment. There's an extremely tiny, I mean, we're talking about, you know, 1/1,000th, 1/10,000th of the population that would look like entrepreneurs or international trade practitioners. But the bulk of human activity, the bulk of products are made by subsistence farmers and small artisanal craftspeople serving people within a short walk of their shop. And then, you know, there's a tiny elite of aristocrats and priests and military and stuff, depending on the time and the place, who are living off the meager surplus created by the farmers. And then the Industrial Revolution, the kind of technical stuff starts happening in the 1700s, but it's really the late 1800s that you start seeing the fruits, like you or the poisons. I mean, it's good and bad. You start seeing, you know, cities getting really big, businesses getting really big. You start seeing, for the first time in human history, a single institution that's run by a small group of people and that tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands, eventually millions of people work for, like Walmart and General Motors and Ford.
Right. The rise of the company man.
And that's brand new. If you look past, you can see hints of it in, you know, military, maybe the Catholic Church, but they're very decentralized because they had to be. There was no telegraph, no rail. So a general really ran his little platoon. It wasn't like Rome is controlling the entire Roman army or the Pope is controlling everything in the way that, say, the leadership team at Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati is controlling the global activity of Procter & Gamble. And that was, in my mind, a kind of double-edged sword for human beings. It brought the widget century, as I call it in the book, this century fueled by mass production of products, you know, ivory soap, Snickers bars, whatever, Ford motor cars.
Right. All the bounty of America.
Of America. The benefit is you suddenly had a huge percentage of the population buffered from the marketplace, buffered from weather. You got a job like my grandfather did, and you didn't have to know each morning, like, did it rain too much last night, or is the price of metal gone up, or you just had a salary.
Relatively stress-free.
Very stress-free. And this idea of a salary, the idea of a career path.
A pension, all of that.
Right. The idea that over time you'll make more money would have been a shocking idea to most people who've ever lived. The idea that people in their 40s make more than people in their 20s, or that kids make more money than their parents and the parents made more money than the grandparents. That's a new idea. Most of human life is fairly flat within an individual's life cycle. But over you look at farmers in ancient Assyria 4,000 years ago, their lives are pretty much like a farmer in medieval France. There's very little movement.
Interesting.
And then very quietly at first and then rather loudly, that system breaks apart. And global trade starts becoming a big issue in the 70s, increasing in the 80s, but really when China joins kind of the global economy in the early 2000s as a full member, that really transforms the world. China alone brought as many people as all the previously industrialized countries combined. So it like doubled the global workforce. And then automation, you know, starting with simple computers, but eventually, you know, robotics, factory machinery. I mean, the machines that make ball bearings now, you know, it's the robots make the robots that make the robots that make ball bearings. And so what you see is a bifurcated economy. So Henry Ford or Procter & Gamble, if they wanted to get rich, they needed to bring a lot of people with them. In the technology that existed before, say, the 70s, you needed lots of factories with lots of workers. You needed marketing departments and accountants and support people.
So it was the rising tide kind of
thing.
And Henry Ford gave them a wage that people had never heard of in that day because he wanted them to buy Model Ts.
Yeah, exactly.
And create a middle class.
And so as that starts falling apart, the rich are still getting richer. The big companies are still getting bigger. They just don't need workers as much, and they don't need to value those workers as much because they can either automate their work away, or mm-hmm. they can go to another country and hire them. And so the value of being sort of a widget worker in a widget company making widgets went from the centerpiece of the U.S. economy to a thing of diminishing and terrifying collapse.
Yeah. Huh.
And that, to me, is the pain side. That is the obviously the incredible dislocation. The positive side, though, is we all now, and it took a while, have access to those tools of automation, of global trade, of the internet. And that allows us to do something that was an extremely complicated process before, which is just to match what we have to give to the people who most want it, even if they're thinly spread all over the world. And that's the transformation that has the potential to be a wonderful tool for, and as you said, I tell the story of lots of people in the book who figured that out.
Yeah, I know that you're from Brooklyn, so no offense, but when I think passion economy, I think of some hipster who's an 18th century cobbler who's making artisanal footwear for people who have $600, $700 to spend on shoes, artisanal bread making, that
right.
kind of thing.
I remember in Brooklyn, artisanal beef jerky became a big thing a few years ago. Yeah, and I probably could like fill the Titanic with pickle makers, modern hipster pickle makers.
Yeah. Is the passion economy more than just the hipster market?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't really have many people who fit that bucket in my book.
Okay.
And I think the passion economy is about finding a way to do a job that only you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the book, one of my kind of heroes is this accountant and who just figured out how to change the way accountants and their customers relate to each other in a way that was more explicitly about adding value and not just helping you pay your taxes. I tell the story of some Amish manufacturers who are solving the problem for other Amish people who want to farm with horses, and how do you create the plows and plow bodies that that support that. It also doesn't – I happen to tell mostly stories of entrepreneurs, but you can do it in a job. The basic lesson applies – I don't think I've found a job or an industry where it doesn't apply, where you are articulating to the people who will give you money why you are able to do something other people can't do, which, of course, is the opposite. So if my grandfather Stanley went into the company that made the machines that made ball bearings and said, oh, I got my own little way of doing it. Yeah. I have a unique passion. They would have been like, shut up, either work the line like we told you or get out of here.
Yeah.
But now it's a robot that's making those machines. But if you can go and say, hey, I have a really unique take on marketing, and I think that you're missing out on some markets that I have an ability to reach – that starts to become an interesting conversation because you're bringing something that they can't just type into a computer and program. So I actually think that the standard, the Etsy model, the craft model, the boutique food model is actually – it could work, but I find that's a very crowded space. It's a very difficult space to stand out.
Interesting.
So it's not one I highly recommend.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to say, it must be refreshing for you to write about people who are actually making this economy work because, as I recall, a lot of your writing has been fairly dark. You covered the economic impact of the Iraq War, the fallout of the Haiti earthquake, the U.S. financial crisis. Plus, these days, it seems like all financial news is so focused on the industries that are going to be doomed or the workers who are going to be left behind. You actually get to tell some pretty uplifting stories in this book.
Yeah, it was a massive departure because, yes, you're exactly right. The vast majority of my career these last 20 years has been grim, dark, ugly news. And I don't see it as, oh, but now I gave up on all that and I think everything's wonderful and don't worry, all the problems are solved and I've figured it out. The passion economy will save us all. I'm not arguing that. What I'm arguing is we have a new logic, and the logic can hurt and the logic can help. And it is exciting. It is more pleasant to spend time on this story, on the positive side of the story, because you're spending time with people. I mean, I chose them carefully. These are people who are not you know, children of the 1% who went to Harvard and inherited $1 billion.
Right.
And
these
are unlikely success stories who are living not just people who are making money. This is not a book about how to become a billionaire. Mm-hmm. Some of the people are millionaires, some are not, but they're all comfortable. They all have security. They all understand the value they're providing, who they're providing it to in what I find a very beautiful way. And I do think that there are a lot of people who could have that life now who don't yet understand how to have that life. And that's okay. What I hope I'm reaching. But that does not lessen the fact that there are many, many people in America and around the world who are likely to have permanently worse lives, and mm-hmm. that the economy does not work for everyone. And so it's not like I'm now only going to write positive stories. I think it is a balance. I often think—
Right. There will be winners and losers, certainly.
There will be winners and losers.
Yeah,
exactly.
You're trying to encourage that there be more winners than losers with this.
Exactly.
And let me ask you this. How does someone find out what their passion is? And how do you know the difference between something that's just a hobby and a passion? Maybe, you know, you enjoy gardening, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you want to become a gardener. How do you figure that out?
That is a really important question, because I do think, and I've talked to guidance counselors at colleges who say the word passion can terrify college kids, because they'll be like, wait, I don't know what my passion is. I guess I'm doomed.
Yeah.
And, you know, to my mind, the word passion is a complex word mm-hmm. and means a lot of different things. I think what I try and define it as in the context of this book and this economy is that bundle of things that you can do uniquely well and you love doing, you want mm-hmm. to do, and that have an audience that is willing to pay money for it. Mm-hmm. But figuring that out internally and then matching that internal thing with some market out there can take a very long time. This is a highly valuable thing to develop, and it is not the kind of thing you should just wait and one morning you wake up and, oh, I know, I want to do gardening. You know, I remember when I lived in LA, I got obsessed with native wildflowers. as like a fun gardening exercise, but I did not like wake up one morning and say, that's going to be my business. So it might take a decade. It might take longer. I don't mm-hmm. think I personally really understood my passion for sort of making economic news accessible to a broad audience who finds economic news off-putting. I would say that is my passion. And I didn't really know that till I was in my late 30s. It took a very long time.
Okay.
And some people are born knowing exactly what they want to do. And some people, or at least know by the time they're 15 or something, and a lot of people don't. And then also, passion can be a product you want to make. Mm-hmm. It can be, but it can also be a way you want to be in the world. So, and a way you are good at being in the world. So, Jason Blummer, the accountant I mentioned.
Right, who is your accountant.
Who's
right?
my accountant now. Yeah, I hired him after. I don't think his passion has ever been accounting. I don't mm-hmm. think he really likes accounting.
Right. He went into his dad's business.
He went
right?
into his dad's yeah. business, although his dad was not a very successful accountant either. But he's now an accountant. But his passion is helping people, and specifically helping creative people, helping mm-hmm. artists and others figure out how to manage their own business, their own economic lives. He would have been very happy never to have been an accountant, but he would have been miserable if he never found the ability to help people in this particular way. I was talking to someone whose mom is a cleaning lady, and she doesn't like being a cleaning lady, mm-hmm. but she needs the job. But what she loves is she's an older woman, an immigrant, who works with a bunch of younger immigrant women, and she has a real passion for helping guide them as they're figuring out how to make it. So
the passion might be just as simple as just having a different customer base, people that you like interacting with, not necessarily the passion for the product.
Or it might be a way of interacting. So mm-hmm. when I do talk to college kids, what I say is, I'm a believer in get a job. Don't wait for your passion to strike.
Right.
Don't worry too much about it, but take a job that seems at least interesting. But just make sure that you're paying a lot of attention to those things that you seem to really find interesting, those people who are doing things mm-hmm. you find exciting, and And also pay attention to what feedback you're getting. What do people tell you you seem to be good at? You know, some people will learn that you can give them a project and they'll just obsessively work on it till it's done. Other people will learn that they're really good at bringing a team together around a project or communicating between different teams. You can imagine lots of lessons like that. And then you pair that with some other interests. So, you know, some other thing you notice, like, you know, and it can be, you know, I like being out of the office. I like interacting with people, or I really love just being in the office and working all day long. I remember talking to someone who, anyway, so it's like a puzzle piece. And what I find, at least in many of the people I write about, is it often you sort of realize you've been doing it a little while at some point. And that can be in your 20s and your 30s. But when you're like, oh yeah, I'm kind of doing it. But now that I know what it is I want to do, I can be more refined, more focused, more careful about making it a real business.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. If staying on top of your budget and protecting your home are goals for this year, take a look at American Home Shield. They give you a plan when stuff breaks down in your home. What kind of stuff? Refrigerators, ovens, heating and air conditioning, plumbing, electrical systems, stuff insurance doesn't cover, and stuff you don't want to mess with or go broke trying to get fixed. If they can't repair the covered item, they'll replace it or offer an alternative solution. As the nation's largest provider, they've paid more in home warranty claims than any other company. Coverage is available no matter how old your systems and appliances are, with plans and pricing to fit every budget. There's also a nationwide network of more than 15,000 licensed professional contractors, so they can find the right pro in your area to fix your problem. Go to ahs.com/kick today to save $50. And start protecting your home and budget from inevitable breakdowns. ahs.com/kick. That's ahs.com/kick for $50 off any plan. American Home Shield. Be sure with Shield. Limitations and exclusions apply. See plan for details. Wave is a free, easy-to-use financial software that helps freelancers, consultants, and small business owners make, move, and manage their money, bringing them closer to financial success through accounting, invoicing, payments, and payroll. Just like Chris. Chris started his own business 3 years ago and has been using Wave ever since. He was never confident about the financial aspects of running his own business, but since discovering Wave, he was relieved to find a service that made invoicing and payments so straightforward. Wave's free accounting, receipt management, and invoicing tools give your business the professionalism it deserves. Have employees? Wave can pay them directly and automate your payroll tax filings. Payroll helps business owners like Sean. Sean felt like he was dealing with taxes and payroll every day, and making sure everyone got paid took away the enjoyment of running his business. Having automatic deductions with payroll let him get back to what he enjoys doing most. I only recently started using Wave for my own accounting and invoicing needs. I was sick of the hassle of invoicing, chasing down clients for payment, juggling all those numbers. It's a headache, and honestly, who needs it? I just wanted to be able to focus on my business and producing my podcast. That's why I really loved Wave's easy-to-use accounting software. It's simple, it's intuitive, and you know what? It saves me time. In fact, now I'm using Wave for my payroll as well. The bottom line here is Wave simplified my life. And you know what? You can't put a price on that. But hey, Wave is free, so that's even better. It's time to ditch the Excel spreadsheets, shoeboxes with receipts, and lost invoices, and start growing your business. Set your business up for financial success by signing up for your free account today at waveapps.com/kick. That's waveapps.com/kick.
I just love some of the case studies that you get into in this book. You mentioned a moment ago the man who found a way to make a living by selling to a very specific customer base, the Amish. Now, just in my mind, I might not think that this would be a very good business model because, hey, the Amish have limited disposable income. They probably want everything handmade, and just the logistical limitations of working with a customer who shuns modern conveniences like the internet and email. How did he make that work?
Yeah, it is an amazing. And it's such a lesson in the idea that even if your niche, your focus is really tiny, mm-hmm. if you super serve that group. So there's about 320,000 Amish in the world. They're pretty much all in the U.S. and Canada. And less than 10% of them farm. So there's maybe 25,000 people who are in the market for horse-drawn farm equipment. Huh. And this company, Pioneer Equipment, is owned by Wayne Wangert and his family, the Wangerts. It employs 50 people. It's a thriving business. The Amish,
and they're not Amish, is that right?
They are Amish.
Oh, they are Amish. Okay.
They are Amish.
I forgot.
So the company has like 4 flip phones for emergencies, but okay. these are not people who are walking around with iPhones. Mm-hmm. They do use a very limited email, but it's very protected, and they can't get images. They can't, you know, they have to follow very strict rules. So they're serving a customer base that is very tiny, that is spread all over in rural areas. And the typical Amish farmer might make 30 grand a year. So like if you went to, you know, some Silicon Valley investor and said, hey, I have identified 25,000 people who make 30 grand a year, live in the most remote corners of the country and don't use the internet or anything. I want to build a multi-million dollar business. It would seem absurd.
Yeah.
But even if you're making $30,000 a year, you have a family who will lend you money. You might be able to get a bank loan. Some Amish do take bank loans. And if you're a farmer, you are going to have a few hundred thousand dollars in farm equipment. Multiply 25,000 by a few hundred thousand in farm equipment, and you quickly realize that you are talking about, you know, a multi-million heading into the billions market. And now you don't just get that market for free. You don't instantly get billions of dollars. You have to really engage that community and create products that they want. I have a lot of Amish friends, weirdly enough, and they are not given money for any frills. You have to truly create a product that is worth the money. So they, even though it's very difficult to communicate with their audience, they do travel a lot. They have actual Amish trade shows that are really fun to
go
to. Yeah, you actually see ads.
I didn't know that.
There's like 3 or 4 different computer makers who target the Amish, and their promotions are how little their computer does. Like, our computer doesn't have any pictures. Oh, our computer doesn't have the internet.
Let me ask you this. Yes, it's a blessing, but doesn't all of this same technology and connectedness that makes this possible also make it easier for, say, someone in Southeast Asia to be able to take your idea and make it at lower cost?
Yeah. So I think of it as like the Goldilocks strategy. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine a market so tiny that you can't make money. So, you know, you make like the most artisanal pickle, but it's, you know, it's disgusting and no one wants to eat it. You can also imagine a market that's big enough that proving it out and being successful will just bring competition immediately. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why Etsy, I think, is not a great model. Etsy,
really?
What you see on Etsy is there's a lot of craftspeople who are carefully making something. And as soon as some category starts working, you see just hundreds of copycat, mm-hmm. often Chinese or other developing countries, just making a knockoff of it. Mm-hmm. I was recently shopping for there's a kind of paper I like. I was also shopping for a wallet. And I found on Etsy, it was almost impossible to differentiate between the actual craftspeople and the kind of cheap knockoffs. So it's finding that sweet spot where your market is big enough to make a real business, but not so big that someone else will care. Now, it turns out that's not so hard.
Really? Because that would seem like that would be a delicate balance. how do you rein in the ambition to want to go big?
Well, you can have that ambition. And one way to manifest that ambition is to have a sort of exit strategy around having a big company buy you out.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of innovation. Consumer packaged goods, that's mm-hmm. basically the stuff you buy on every trip to the supermarket, you know, everything from laundry detergent to chocolate bars to, you know, just anything that comes prepackaged with, you know, cellophane around it. And that whole category, the big companies, Procter & Gamble, Unilever, are having a true innovation crisis. They're really not coming up with new ideas. I see this when I take my 8-year-old to look at the candy aisle in a deli, and I'm like, it's weird that most of the candy he's seeing is candy that was there when I was a kid. And now Kit Kat comes in mint and dark chocolate, and Snickers now has almonds. But it's very minor variations on a theme.
Mm-hmm.
And so you are seeing an incredible burgeoning consumer packaged goods innovation economy that's not unlike the pharmaceutical industry, where people are coming up with – so this is the kind of Brooklyn hipster on steroids, where you come up with a product, whether it's a beverage or a candy or whatever, and you're basically your whole goal is to get Procter & Gamble or Unilever to buy you out. But then there's lots of other people like, I don't want that. I just want my business. And you know what? If I can bring in $10 million a year in revenue, I can pay myself $400,000 a year, and I'm building up some equity that when I retire, I can have a nice retirement and maybe – take care of my family, that's a really good life. That is not a terrible life. And in Silicon Valley, they dismissively call it a lifestyle business. Mm. But again and again and again, I'm fine. Now, what the market is will determine what the size is. So if you're selling farm equipment that costs thousands or tens of thousands of dollars, 2,500 people might be enough. If you're selling chocolate bars, 2,500 probably isn't enough, but you don't want. So I tell the story of Ocho,
yeah,
which is a great chocolate bar. Yeah. I love their chocolate bar.
And they managed to scale up.
Yes, and they're...
But do they still keep the passion? How does that work? How do you scale up but still have the passion?
They have enormous passion, and part of it is really you have to fight for it as a culture. Mm-hmm. They make a lot of choices that are, frankly, non-economic choices, you know, hand-making a lot of the ingredients, even as they scale up. So you... Ocho makes some wonderful chocolate bars. My favorite is the peanut butter and jelly. I also like the coconut. And they make it in a special way where it's the chocolate is hard on the outside and soft on the inside. I mean, this was something I didn't really realize, that most chocolate bars you think of, like Snickers, there's something hard on the center, and then the chocolate is kind of soft and thin and mushy on the outside.
Yeah.
And that's for industrial reasons. That's not for taste reasons. It's just
the nougat or whatever.
Yeah, it's just easier to have for mass production. It's easier to have this hard thing, and you put it, they call it enrobing. It goes through basically a waterfall of chocolate. Now, Ocho does something much more complicated where they actually freeze essentially a chocolate, it kind of looks like a coffin, like a chocolate box, put the soft center inside, and then put more chocolate on top and freeze that. It's much more complicated, much more fussy and expensive, but much more delicious. And they're now available in CVS and lots of chain Albertsons, you know, lots of chain places.
Yeah, I got to look for that.
But their biggest dream is to be a $100 million a year company. Now, that sounds huge, but their biggest dream is to basically be a few minutes of the Snickers line. Like Snickers, like it turns out $100 million is just not worth waking up for at Snickers. You know, that's,
VCs aren't going to get excited about a $100 million company.
Exactly, right. Yeah. That's it, right. It's not the next Snapchat.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it depends on the it depends on the market. It depends on the industry. But it is very possible. Also, you do have to keep your eye on the ball. I mean, I think very much the 20th century model was you create a product, and then that's basically what you do. And maybe there's minor variations every few years. I would say in the passion economy, it constantly understanding your customer and how you have to adjust the product to serve that customer's need is the other way you keep the business.
Okay.
So I tell the story of General Pencil, which is a pencil manufacturer.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to be a pencil manufacturer in the U.S. because it costs – like Chinese companies can send a dozen pencils that cost less than it costs the raw material to make one pencil. But they identified this market, which is in between the super cheap like Chinese commodity pencil you find in Staples – and the super high-end, like luxury German pencil that artists want. And they found like there's this audience of parents and art students and just amateur artists who want a pretty good pencil. They don't want just a cheap number two pencil, but they're not going to spend $3 on some gorgeous German masterpiece. And so they, you know, they want an 80-cent pencil. And they just identified this market. They stay on top of the market by constantly adjusting the pencils themselves, putting the pencils in these kits. So you can just go to the stationery store, buy a kit, and it'll teach you how to draw whatever you want to draw. And they just stay in contact with that customer. And it's big enough that they're doing great, but it's small enough that, you know, there's not going to be a Chinese factory has to make a lot of pencils, fill up a container ship, send it by sea to the U.S. They're not going to be able to stay on in that kind of relationship with that kind of customer.
Right. You tell a couple of stories about these 90 or 100-year-old companies that have been passed down through the family and were going under because they were still operating a commodity business and they managed to transition into passion economy models. Another good example is the Braun Brush Company from, I think, New York or New Jersey. Was it difficult for these old companies who are so entrenched in these old business models to be able to adapt?
It was terrible. It was most, I mean, many of the, you know, America used to have a lot more family-owned manufacturing businesses. And I don't have the statistics at hand, but I'm pretty sure more than the vast majority have died. And and that's the story we hear, right? The 100-year-old factory, China starts competing,
right.
They struggle and struggle and struggle, and then they fail. The ones who succeed realize that everything they did to get where they are no longer applies. That the 20th century model, so this is Braun Brush, you're right, it's in Long Island, New York. And it's it was a family company that made brushes, mostly for the food industry, a pizza oven cleaning brush. They made special brushes for like chocolate shops, that, like beaver hair brushes that like are perfect for rubbing chocolate on pastries and stuff.
Yeah, and they started out as milk brush company.
Milk bottle cleaning brushes. Yeah. Yes, but like pretty much the entire U.S. economy, their focus was sell as many as you can to as many people as you can.
And right, so floor brushes, that floor kind of thing,
whatever, margin, they can come up with. As much volume as you can. And then, and that worked for 100 years. They did great. And then Chinese companies started exporting much cheaper brushes. Same story we hear all the time. The finished brush is much cheaper than the raw material for the new brush. And the company was struggling, losing money every year, looking grim. The owner, Max Cheney, and his son, Lance Cheney, they got along very well, but they would argue. And Lance would say, "We have to change everything. We have to change everything." And his dad would say, "No, it's worked for 100 years. It'll be fine." Max died at work, you know, worked till his last, a very old man. And Lance took over and he just said, "We're not competing with China. As soon as a brush comes to America from China, we're not going to make that brush anymore," which is really hard because China is only looking at their biggest sellers. Why else would they make a brush? So it meant
all
of our biggest sellers were going to stop selling.
So you have to be nimble.
You have to be wildly nimble. And he said, "What we're going to do is we're not going to make money in volume. We're going to make money by coming up with brush solutions to major problems." And it turns out there are a lot of brush solutions to major problems. And so Lance has transformed his company from a machine to make lots and lots and lots of brushes as cheaply and quickly as possible to a machine that scours the world looking for opportunities to solve people's problems with brushes. So the first example was Lance learned about a nuclear power plant that had this problem where he actually just picked up the phone. Someone called him and said, "Hey, you're a brush company. We have this problem. We use this brush to clean the pipes when we're inspecting them, but they shed staples because the staples hold the bristles on. And we now have all these staples sloshing around in the coolant liquid that's really dangerous." And now Lance's dad might have said, "What are we going to do? Sell this guy 5 brushes? Like, get out of here." But Lance realized that's a big problem. If we solve that problem, that's kind of cool.
So it's Lance, back to that feedback loop with the customer.
With the customer, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so Lance created a a brush actually modeled on his great-grandfather's milk bottle cleaning brush that had no staples. The bristles were attached very carefully. It was made out of a special kind of nylon that was non-reactive to nuclear to radiation. And it was the perfect solution. And it cost $12 to make, which is a lot for a brush. But he's not going to sell it for $24 because this is solving a massive problem. So he could make up any number. He happened to make up $6,000. He sells the brush for $6,000 each. And it's now a standard piece of equipment at nuclear power plants the world over.
Wow. Huh.
And that's a customer who, yes, maybe some Chinese manufacturer could make the brush for $8. But the cost of failure is so much higher than the $6,000 they pay that they'd rather just stick with the guy who invented the thing and that they trust. He learned that NASA was building these Mars rovers and that they were having a problem that the Mars rovers go to inspect rock. If there's dust on the rock, it gets in the way. And so he created a very specialized brush that cleans away the dust from the rock when the rover inspects them. Mars is a very hostile environment. It gets very hot, then gets very cold in the same day. Obviously, it has to be very light, so it has to be very durable. It has to last. And so he now has two brushes on Mars, on two Mars rovers, which is pretty cool. And, you know, the price for that is not going to be like what they used to call or still call cost plus. Like, it cost me $10. I'm going to charge $20. It's whatever you want, because you are the only guy who can solve this problem. And the problem's a big, big, big problem.
Huh. And it occurs to me right now that, you know, you're a podcaster, I'm a podcaster, and podcasting seems to me like a great example of the passion economy at work. You know, anytime I talk to people who are thinking about getting into the business, I always tell them that this is a medium that rewards passion. You don't have to be some big celebrity with an incredibly broad show. Some of the most popular podcasts are very niche, something like 99% Invisible, which is entirely a design podcast.
Absolutely. I think of podcasting, I mean, I almost think like the whole book is secretly just about podcasting because
really?
Because that's my life. You know, I was an NPR reporter for many years, and public radio, like all broadcast, national broadcast radio, you know, you create a product that has to go to millions of people all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And you want, you know, you know that 80-year-olds in Alabama and 28-year-olds in San Francisco, and you want people everywhere to listen to it.
Right. And there's only about, what, 3 or 4 hours out of the day that people are really listening.
Exactly.
Anyways.
Exactly. So, yeah. So it's Morning Edition and all things considered. In that case, mm-hmm. Morning and Drive Time. And so you create kind of like Ivory Soap. You create, you know, I love NPR. It's a very valuable service, but even the people who love NPR the most know there's a kind of not – passion is not necessarily the word you would use. There's
right.
a very calm, comfortable way of talking
yeah.
and a sort of general, like, it's for everybody and therefore for nobody kind of feel to it. And podcasting is a totally different experience. And so I think of – broadcast radio is a good metaphor or good example of the 20th century model. You know, mm-hmm. Ivory Soap is made in a factory and then shipped everywhere. Coca-Cola, it's the same flavor even in, you know, rural China and Los Angeles. It's the same thing for everyone. You need everyone to like it enough to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I'm sure there are people who are fanatics for Coca-Cola and Ivory, but for most of us, it's just part of the universe and we just accept it. And much like broadcast radio, but podcasting, each person is programming their own radio station by actively selecting what they're going to listen to. And even though it's a fairly, you know, it's free and quick and easy, it's still an active engagement that's very different from passively turning on the radio.
Yeah.
You can also pause them. You can rewind them. You can fast forward them. You can stop listening.
Right.
and it has completely transformed the world of audio. When I got into radio in the early 90s, it really was a lot like joining the post office. Like, people, certainly in public radio, like, once you pass a few hurdles and get your first job, you're pretty much safe bet you're going to retire at 65.
You're a lifer. Yeah.
And you probably know how much you're going to make. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you if you work at a local station, you know, you'll make this much. If you get to the network, you'll make a little bit more. But you're never going to get rich. You're never going to go broke. It's all solid and safe. And then podcasting comes along, and it's spiky and confusing, and there's so much of it. But so many people find their shows. And I bet if you and I looked at each other's devices, we'd see that there's a handful of shows we both love and then a ton of shows you love that I've never heard of and vice versa.
Yeah.
And probably some shows I love that you hate and vice versa. Because passion, by definition in my mind, has to be an intense feeling, which means the more one group loves it, the more some other group hates it. And in my own life, so I lived in a world of public radio. Everyone made the same amount of money. I mean, it was like living in a socialist, you know, operation.
Some would say it is.
Yeah, exactly. But I now know people who make million, who are million, multi-millionaires. I mean, we just saw The Ringer just sold for hundreds of millions to Spotify. Gimlet sold for hundreds of millions to Spotify.
Right. Yeah, there are a lot of big podcast deals happening right now. Spotify's in the game in a huge way. You recently did a deal with Sony,
a podcast deal with Sony.
As podcasts scale up, do they run the risk of losing passion? Is there a podcast bubble on the horizon?
I think there's definitely deal bubbles. I think that there are I think prices are wildly inflated. I think what's the way I see it is right now the big players are like podcasting, as you know, was this kind of homegrown DIY kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then in the last year plus, major media companies are like, oh, wait, this thing is is actually real. We should get in
and
on
real
it.
Real advertisers. Not just meal kit delivery services.
Exactly. Although we love our meal kit delivery services, of course. And so I think there's a jockeying for position. And I think so you do see deals that just don't seem to make any rational sense. I mean, it feels a bit like the internet bubble.
But they're also, I guess, there are a lot of these larger companies that are just trying to play catch up now, like Spotify.
Exactly. Let's buy ourselves some legitimacy. But much like the internet bubble, there can be a deal bubble at the deal level. But long term, like, I think it's safe to say more people will be listening to more hours of more podcasts in the future. And there will be more money being spent. So the industry...
That's good to know.
So that you know, if you think of the internet bubble, lots of individual companies were insanely overvalued, but the internet was barely getting going. I mean, the internet as a class was barely starting. I mean, we didn't have Wi-Fi yet. We didn't have most people didn't have any access to high-speed internet. We didn't have the whole 2.0 internet. We didn't have mobile. So I think the ecosystem of podcasting is only going to grow dramatically. But any individual deal, I mean, frankly, I would prefer it if the valuations got a little more rational. Maybe after I get my next valuation,
there you go.
the next day.
And then me.
Yeah, and then you.
Okay.
But the other thing I would point out is, and this is another key hallmark of this new economy, is in the 20th century, you often had very highly structured and even calcified business models. So radio was an advertising model. Podcasting is still primarily funded through advertising, but there it's a much richer array of business models. So some people podcast really to get their message out there so they can get customers for some other
service. It's a great marketing tool.
It's a great marketing tool. We're in the early days still, but I do think subscriptions and kind of pay per listen will grow.
More of a Netflix model?
Something like that. My guess is it'll have different manifestations. But and then podcasts as a way to generate intellectual property for movies and TV, for books. So I think and that's not something we've talked too much about, but there's the business model, the way you cap, you know, there's creating the unique value that you alone can create, but then there's capturing that value, which is a whole separate thing. And how you do that, how that's structured, that is very complex and changing rapidly, I would say.
Well, before we go, I'm curious, on the macro level, do you see the passion economy as the kind of thing that might just save a few forward-thinking entrepreneurs while the rest of us get automated out of existence? Or is it maybe even the kind of economic revolution that could have a much larger impact, maybe even boost the GDP?
So my view on this is, like, I'm not advocating for the passion. I'm not like, oh, mm-hmm. we don't have the passion economy, but I wish we did.
Yeah.
What I feel I'm doing, obviously I could be wrong, is I'm describing what is happening.
Okay.
And so in a sense, I make the analogy to the shift from agriculture to the Industrial Revolution, which is to say, yes, there were early industrial pioneers who became very, very rich, mm-hmm. but eventually it was no longer a choice. It wasn't like, oh, should I get into the Industrial Revolution or should I stay in farming? Like, it's
right.
You're
right. It's an existential
even the Amish,
choice. Yeah,
who made the most, we're going to stay in farming, are still part of the Industrial Revolution. So I think the passion economy is here. The rules are different, and understanding the rules, you'll do better. I also think it's not a switch where either you're 100% passionate or 0%. I think you can apply, you can understand the rules and apply, you know, make your life 6% more passionate. Then next year, make it 12%. So I do think that the basic idea that being a cog in a widget mm-hmm. making business is a bad forward-looking strategy,
yeah.
I think is true and will only get truer. And that identifying those things that are uniquely, that you uniquely can bring. Now, that doesn't mean mm-hmm. you have to be Elon Musk. That can mean you're the janitor who really motivates other janitorial staff. You know, okay. this can operate at levels where we're not talking about wild wealth and entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. We're talking about just being a little more mindful of, I seem to be adding this extra value. And then it's figuring that out. Then it's articulating it to your boss. So you say, hey, have you noticed that the shifts I'm on, we get everything done faster and you have fewer injuries because I'm a good leader? I think you should reward me.
Yeah. Okay.
And then if you have a boss who can't do that, maybe you start thinking about going to a different company. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's a savior. I don't think I'm certainly not predicting everyone's better off forever. But I do think the more people understand this and the sooner they begin to follow these rules, the better off they'll be.
For sure. Well, it was such a great read. Again, the book is called The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century. Adam Davidson, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks so much. This was really fun.
Thanks again to Adam Davidson for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Read his regular column in The New Yorker and follow him on Twitter at Adam Davidson. American Home Shield, America's most preferred home warranty, gives you a plan when stuff breaks down in your home, stuff insurance doesn't cover, and stuff you don't want to mess with or go broke trying to get fixed. Go to ahs.com/kick today to save $50 and start protecting your home and budget from inevitable breakdowns. That's ahs.com/kick for $50 off any plan. American Home Shield. Be sure with Shield. Limitations and exclusions apply. See plan for details. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com. And I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.